From Philip Roth, The Ghostwriter, page 34. Do you have a girlfriend? Lonoff asked me. I explained the situation, to the extent that I was willing to. Betsy had found out about me and a girl she had known since ballet school. The two of us had kissed over a glass of Gallo in the kitchen. Playfully, she had shown me the tip of her wine-stained tongue, and I, quick to take heart, had pulled her out of her chair and down beside the sink. This took place one evening when Betsy was off dancing at the city center, and the friend had stopped by to pick up a record and investigate a flirtation he'd begun some months earlier, when Betsy was away touring with the company. On my knees, I struggled to unclothe her. Not resisting all that strenuously, she, on her knees, told me what a bastard I was to be doing this to Betsy. I refrained from suggesting that she might be less than honorable herself. Trading insults while in heat wasn't my brand of aphrodisia, and I was afraid of a fiasco if I should try it and get carried away. So, shouldering the burden of perfidy for two, I pinned her pelvis to the kitchen linoleum, while she continued through moist, smiling lips to inform me of my character flaws. I was then at the stage of my erotic development when nothing excited me as much as having intercourse on the floor. Betsy was a romantic, excitable, high-strung girl who could be left quivering by the backfire of a car. So when the friend intimated over the phone to her a few days later that I wasn't to be trusted, it nearly destroyed her. It was a bad time for her anyway. Yet another of her rivals had been cast as a cygnet in Swan Lake, and so, 4 years after having been enlisted by Balanchine as a 17-year-old of great promise, she had yet to rise out of the Corps, and it didn't look to her now as though she ever would. And how she worked to be the best. Her art was everything, a point of view no less beguiling to me than the large painted gypsy girl eyes and the small, unpainted she-monkey face, and those elegant, charming tableaux she could achieve, even when engaged in something so aesthetically uncompromising as, half asleep in the middle of the night, taking a lonely pee in my bathroom. When we were first introduced in New York, I knew nothing about ballet and had never seen a real dancer on the stage, let alone off. An army friend who'd grown up next door to Betsy in Riverdale had gotten tickets for a Tchaikovsky extravaganza and then exchanged for a girl who was dancing in it to have coffee with us around the corner from the city center that afternoon. Fresh from rehearsal and enchantingly full of herself, Betsy amused us by recounting the horrors of her self-sacrificing vocation, a cross, as she described it, between the life of a boxer and the life of a nun. And the worrying. She had begun studying at the age of 8 and had been worrying ever since about her height and her weight and her ears and her rivals and her injuries and her chances. Right now, she was in absolute terror about tonight. I myself couldn't see that she had reason to be anxious about anything, least of all those years, so entranced was I already by the dedication and the glamour. At the theater, I unfortunately couldn't remember, once the music had begun and dozens of dancers rushed on stage, whether earlier she had told us she was one of the girls in lavender with a pink flower in their hair or one of the girls in pink with a lavender flower in their hair, and so I spent most of the evening just trying to find her. Each time I thought that the legs and arms I was watching were Betsy's, I became so elated I wanted to cheer. But then another pack of 10 came streaking across the stage, and I thought, no, there, that's her. You were wonderful, I told her afterward. Yes? Did you like my little solo? It's not actually a solo, it lasts only about 15 seconds, but I do think it's awfully charming. Oh, I thought it was terrific, I said. It seems like more than 15 seconds to me. A year later, our artistic and amatory alliance came to an end when I confessed that the mutual friend had not been the first girl to be dragged onto the floor while Betsy was safely off dancing her heart out, and I had nighttime hours with nothing to do and nobody to stop me. I had been at this for some time now, and I admitted it was no way to be treating her. Bold honesty, of course, produced far more terrible results than if I had only confessed to seducing the wily seductress and left it at that. Nobody had asked me about anybody else. But carried away by the idea that if I were a perfidious brute, I would at least be a truthful perfidious brute, I was crueler than was either necessary or intended. In a fit of penitential gloom, I fled from New York to Croisset, where eventually I managed to absolve myself of the sin of lust and the crime of betrayal by watching from behind the blade of the snowplow as it cleared the colony roads from my solitary and euphoric walks, walks during which I did not hesitate to embrace trees and kneel down and kiss the glistening snow. So bursting was I with a sense of gratitude and freedom and renewal.